Welcome to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. In the past year, we've brought you stories about the land, the farms, and the people of Delmarva. Throughout the year, it became clear to us that our listeners want to see the rural character of Delmarva survive. So we began to look deeper into certain questions. What will it take to keep farmers on their land? Is it possible to tend to the health of the environment and also to the needs of the people of our state and our nation? We will explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we can get there together. This week, we take a ride through Prince George's County to visit three very different farms. I mean, who knew this Metro DC County had 60,000 acres of fertile farmland? The farmers we talked with all had very interesting perspectives on farming, about how you define the idea of sustainability, and how small independent farmers can remain economically viable in a highly controlled agricultural marketplace. The first farm we stopped to visit was run by the Akakik Foundation, an educational farm on the Potomac River in Piscataway Park. They have many programs that focus on how to build and train for sustainable agriculture, organic farming, and programs for young people. Dr. Lisa Hayes is the president and CEO of the Akakik Foundation. She talked to us about the history of this place and the Akakik Foundation as well, as we looked across the Potomac at Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington.
So the Akakik Foundation was created 55 years ago. We were incorporated in 1957. A congresswoman named Frances Bolton from Ohio bought this land to preserve the view from Mount Vernon. And in a moment you will see why. There was the threat of development here, so she bought the land to protect it. And then in the 1960s, eminent domain was, I think, about to be used by a public utility. So we were part of an effort to donate land to the federal government for the creation of a national park. And that's how we came to be Piscataway Park. So Piscataway Park is, I think, maybe 5,000 acres, but we steward 200 acres. There is Mount Vernon.
That's Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this part of Maryland is also at the heart of what was the Piscataway Nation. When Captain John Smith sailed up the Potomac River, and he stopped right about in the same area, and that's where he met the Piscataway Indians.
So, now, when you call this, I thought you had a whole program here that was built around the Piscataway, don't you?
We are working on that. We are involved in what we're calling the Piscataway Cultural Landscape Initiative, and the idea is to interpret this site using the indigenous lens of the Piscataway people. So when you think of museums, you think about objects and artifacts and archaeological remnants. But we want to look at the landscape as the object, the artifact, and its cultural meaning and importance to the Piscataway people, both in the past and the present.
That was Dr. Lisa Hayes, president and CEO of the Akakik Foundation. Our next stop was a tour of their ecosystem farm. The ecosystem farm trains farmers in organic agricultural methods. The soil was degraded by years of growing tobacco, and they had to work to replenish it to make it ready for the vegetables they grow now. Community outreach and education coordinator Molly Meehan told us about the farm and the farmer trainings.
It's about 8 fenced acres. We have about between 1 and 3 in cultivation at any time. It's a certified organic vegetable operation. Vegetable and fruit. We do have a stand of figs and some brambles. And so we've been doing farmer training here for about 20 years. And every season we have at least about 2 apprentices. We've trained about 40 folks that have gone through our program so far, as well as interns that come to work on the farm. And they come for a full sort of season immersion into the rhythm of farm life, as well as they have an on-farm portion where they're actually working on the production components of the farm. We have about a 60-share CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, And then they also have off-site or off-the-farm programs that they attend, both the educational programs we have here, as well as programs that we attend in the community, like CRAFT, which is a group of young farmers, Chesapeake Regional Alliance for Farmer Training, and that do visits around to different operations in the area. So it's a pretty comprehensive program that they have. They're here for about 10 months with options to continue on if they so choose.
So who are the people who come here to learn how to farm? Are they farmers who are already farming and to come in to learn organic farming? Are they new farmers who want to get into farming? Who
are they? It depends. Most farmers now that are beginning to farm have not necessarily farmed before. They're changing careers or they're coming just out of college and wanting to learn how to farm. We usually are not at the stage where we have folks that are at the exploratory space where they're like, farming sounds cool, but haven't really necessarily done it before. Usually folks that come here have between one and sometimes three plus seasons of farming experience, and they come here to learn things like tractor and machinery operation. So they're going to want to learn, you know, deepen their skills with various tools that they have here, or diversified vegetable operations, things like that. So they're looking for a specific experience, but what they're looking for varies on their experience before. This year, Sky, who's one of our apprentices, had really focused on, he'd worked with livestock, he'd worked doing a lot of like horticulture and landscaping. In his vision for his future, he really wants to incorporate a vegetable operation. And so he came here really wanting to learn about a vegetable operation, biointensive growing, organic growing, things like that. So it's an interesting space. I think we really try to teach at a scale-less level. Mm-hmm. So we realize that some folks are going to go on and want to have a larger scale operation. And some folks are going to go on, like another one of our apprentices. She's interested in urban agriculture. And so it's sort of like being able to teach basic skills that would then be able to be applied at the various scales that we see in agriculture today.
That was Molly Meehan talking about the Ecosystem Farm at the Akakik Foundation. We then bumped into Sky Harmon, Ecosystem Farm Apprentice for this 2012 season.
So I'm a native West Virginian. And I lived all around the West Coast for most of my adult life and have decided to come back here to farm in West Virginia. But there isn't really the opportunities to get an education in sustainable agriculture there. And so I was seeking for opportunities that provided a decent stipend and also, you know, a good foundation in sustainable agriculture. And found this place among a number of others, but I felt that being a regional a center, you know, where I can relate to cultural values, but also at the same time kind of the agricultural problems and situations that we face, that it was the best fit. And so I started here in March. And the apprenticeship lasts for 10 months, so it will be ending at the end of November.
Then what?
My intention is to start a CSA in West Virginia for next year.
What kind of stuff are you learning here?
A lot of it is kind of systems thinking at this point. Understanding how things go together. I do have a bit of farming experience before this, and I've been gardening basically my whole life and worked professionally as a gardener, but learning production techniques and also understanding how things go together and what we can do to make them work. And one of the great things about this place is that it's challenging. And that was one of the things that excited me most about it, because I feel like if you can learn in a difficult environment with limiting factors, then you're much more capable when those restrictions are taken off of you. So here, we are off the grid. All of our water and power is provided by this solar panel and the one that you probably saw out near the river. Which creates a lot of limits to it, but you really have to understand your resources in that way. You know, we can only do so much water in a day. And so I feel like what I'm really learning is to think fluidly about the kind of processes. In today's climate, you have to think about the kind of like changing nature of the environment, you know, and you have to respond a lot more kind of like rapidly to what's going on. You can't really expect it to always be wet or always be dry or always be hot. You really have to know how to change your practice to meet, you know, that those kind of needs.
It's really interesting when people talk about sustainable agriculture, because it's not like we're going back to anything that was ever really sustainable. It's always been a system that was based on either exploitation or unsustainable practices or something like that. So really, when you talk about sustainable agriculture in the future, it's pretty brand new.
A lot of old farmers tell us just the opposite, that what they're doing is going back to the way they knew.
So like some subsistence farming and things like that, I guess some would argue would be about the closest to sustainable, you know, communities that were based on subsistence farming and had some kinds of trade involved with them. But on a large scale, there hasn't been as much of a truly sustainable system, you know. It's a new era. Things also didn't used to be as globalized as they are now, so.
Right. I think they're thinking more about the Maryland had a huge truck farming industry.
Right, yeah.
Which was, you know, and that were just rotating crops and moving their animals around and selling their crops. And it's I think that's what they're saying, right, that they were hearkening back to.
A lot of people say, yeah, it's like commonly said, like, yeah, we're going back to the way things were before. And I think in some ways that is the case. But it's like looking at it through a lens of, like, what does sustainability actually mean, and what does it mean in the modern context?
What does it mean in the modern context to you?
I think that our system has to kind of move towards a concept that's called food sovereignty. And that's really more of a decentralized agricultural system that's based on the participation and control of our food systems by local communities, and less centralized like it is right now. So it's not like trade can't occur or something like that, but it's really culturally appropriate food systems that are community-based.
That was Molly Meehan, Community Outreach and Education Coordinator from the Akakik Foundation. Next up on our tour was a visit to see Akakik's cattle. We met up with livestock manager Polly Festa. I noticed she had a tattoo of a cow on her arm and asked her about it. I see you wear your husbandry on your arm.
Yes. My grandmother bred Jersey cows for 60 years. She passed away last year. She's the one who got me to love farming. So I, in her memory, put a Jersey calf on my arm to remind me why I do what I love.
Where was your farm?
Upstate New York. I was born and raised about 20 miles from Cooperstown. And no, I've never been to the Hall of Fame.
And you came here specifically to work livestock? Is that why you came here?
I'm here for the livestock.
And where did you learn it? From your grandparents?
I learned it from my grandmother and my mother, cattle specifically. And then I went to college at the State University of New York at Cobleskill, majored in livestock for my 2-year degree, agricultural business for my 4-year degree, and then a lot of on-the-fly training.
That's great. That's great. This is all part of Akakik here?
Yes, yes.
This is where you came in?
Oh, yes.
So,
right.
So we'll go to the parking lot to pick them up, and then we'll drive to the other end to the barn.
So with our farmer training programs, we have the vegetable operation where we have apprentices and interns, and we also have the livestock operation as well. And so we do education both with folks with livestock as well as with the vegetables. And the livestock is particularly important. I mean, they're both obviously really important, but there's so many fewer opportunities in livestock, sustainable livestock operation, especially the heritage breeds. And so it's really unique, the offerings that we've got here. Plus, we offer, I mean, we value so much, you know, folks coming here and developing their craft as farmers, so they, you know, get a good stipend and health insurance and all these kinds of things that are pretty unique in the world of farmer training and apprenticeship programs. And so I think that's just something that just shows, I guess, how much value that we see in training farmers and getting more farmers onto the ground.
And these steers are what?
No, these are mamas.
These are mamas.
And they all should be bred as long as my boy did his job.
Hey. What's going on?
Not much. It's been fenced set up.
Yeah, what?
Cool.
Our bull works for 2 months a year, and his job should be complete.
The breed.
They're Red Devons.
Red Devons.
And right there is Miss Mercy.
And Red Devons are good for milk?
Yeah, Red Devon is what they're commonly called in the museum world. They're American Milking Devons is the breed name. They are solely unique to the United States. They are the only remnant of the Devon breed that still has the tri-purpose use. They are for milk, meat, and for draft power. They're reputed to be the quickest oxen. They will trot down the road at 6 miles an hour with the wagon. So the biggest problem people have is they're typically smarter than they are. Which, growing up on a Jersey farm, I'm used to. But these guys are actually smarter than Jerseys, which I never thought I'd say about any breed of cattle.
Sally Fallon Morell and Jeffrey Morell of Brandywine, Maryland, might disagree about that. They love their Jerseys on the P.A. Bowen Farmstead, the first dairy farm in Prince George's County in 36 years. Much of their milk goes to the raw artisan cheese that they make on the farm. They also raise chickens, pigs, turkeys in a mixed-species pasture-based farm that incorporates biodynamic methods. We started out with a tour of their dairy operation. The cleanest I think I've ever seen. Almost pristine.
The Jerseys are all named after opera stars or opera singers. And our bull's name is Domingo.
As a brother, do you have a brother Placido?
Well, he is very Placido. He's very calm.
He's a calm one.
He's very calm.
That's good.
For a Jersey bull, you never take your eyes off his eyes.
Right, because...
You never can tell. Truly, I never. So you're, because through his eyes, you can see what his actions are likely to be. And you're looking for where's the fence.
We like to say we're a traditional farm using space-age techniques. So it's very traditional, old-fashioned in the sense that we have pasture-fed cows and so forth. But we use something called the co-pulsation milking system, which is brand new, newly invented, and that is very gentle on the teats of the cows. And we've gotten our infection rate on the udders way, way down because of that. We've seen a huge difference.
So what does that mean? I mean, what is it usually, and how do you have it down, and what does that mean for the cow and for the milk?
Yeah, we get tested every month by the state in something called somatic cell count, which is actually the white blood cell count. Now, all milk has white blood cells in it. That's why it's so good for the immune system. But you don't want an elevated count. That means that the cow is somehow fighting infection in the udder. We do spot tests, something called the California mastitis test, that we test the milk from each quarter of the cow. And if there's a problem with one of the teats, that milk is milked separately. It's not thrown away. It's used to feed the calves. This is only possible in a small system.
Why is it only possible?
In a very large system, you wouldn't have the manpower to be testing, and you wouldn't want to stop your production to take separately the milk from one quarter. And you wouldn't be giving your cows milk anyway. You'd be giving them milk replacer or hay or something.
What's the difference between a family farm and one of those big corporate farms where they're milking 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cows, where the food is all brought to them? Here, the cows go out into the pasture.
So I'm curious, now that you've mentioned that, I'm curious what you think, whether just practically or theoretically, how farms like yours, how do they fit into a larger scheme of feeding people? In other words, you know, people are wrestling with this notion, how can you feed the American people? If you don't have an industrial model that raises enough animals, milk and whatever for people, you can't do it on a scale like this. I mean, what do you think about that?
I don't agree with that. You actually get far more production per acre in this model. Because we're not just milking cows on this pasture. We're raising chickens and pigs and the abundance.
Turkeys.
Yeah, and turkeys. The turkey's about to come. So the abundance that you get from this model is incredible. We have so much land in this country that could be small farms. What we need is an appreciation for the products of these farms and a distribution system. And it's a distribution system that would be very different from the centralized, industrialized system what we have today. But I do not agree with the... It's almost like a mantra. It's like a dogma. We couldn't feed the world with small organic farms. And I think that's absolutely wrong. I think we would feed the world very well with small organic farms. Nothing is as wasteful as using our entire prairies to make high fructose corn syrup and soybean oil, which is what we're doing now.
And here, of course, the production is a little bit different. But fortunately, the county is rather receptive to what we're doing. But we still have to obey the regulations and live within the rules of all the bacteria counts and so on like that.
The state has been very supportive. They want this to succeed. So they're very strict with us. I can understand that, too. But it's not like they're being strict because they want to put us out of business. They're being strict because they want us to succeed. One thing that Jeffrey said he would do differently if he farmed again was he would only milk once a day. So we get about 20% less production by milking once a day, but our labor costs are cut in half because of that. And the butterfat stays the same. So the upshot is that we end up with a very creamy cheese.
Now, one thing about this farm, there is no soy bean in any shape or form being fed to any of the chickens or the cows or pigs or anything else.
Now, why is that significant?
Sally's the big answer here.
I've been the big voice warning people about the dangers of soybeans. The dangers of soybeans in the animals is that the isoflavones, the estrogen-like substances, can get in the egg yolks and skin of the chickens. They get in the milk fat. And we want really soy-free animal foods. And we have a lot of customers who are extremely sensitive to soy and are very grateful to us for doing that. We use a mix that is one-third local sorghum, one-third local wheat. And we would like to get local legumes like black-eyed peas, but they're not available yet. We're hoping a farmer will do that for us. But we get field peas from Pennsylvania. And then for the cows, they just get 2 or 3 pounds a day, and a very special mineral mix for the cows goes in with the meal. It's ground and soaked overnight for the cows, so it's very gentle on them.
You've got to give them the answer about this, the whole soy thing. Everybody that's on soy has got a thyroid problem. That's to start with. And then the men are growing breasts, you see, and more men are having breast reductions today than women are.
Really?
True. They had a symposium on that in Washington.
Because of soy?
Mainly because of soy.
That's right. Yeah. Soy. And unfortunately, I've got to say the other way around, and the ladies lose their libido because they get too much estrogen in their bodies, you see.
Because of soy.
Uh-huh. But now, and one more thing, a lot of farmers are noticing a real decline in fertility, especially with the genetically modified soy, which has kind of taken over. This farm is very fertile. We bred 14 cows this year. We got 14 healthy calves. We have huge litters of pigs. So, you know, that can really kill you on a farm is to not have the good fertility.
We were talking about soy. I mean, but then people... Some people, I guess, have seen and read or argued that in the Asian world, where people grow up on tofu rather than meat, there's longevity, there's health.
But that's not correct. In the Asian world, the average consumption is 2 tablespoons per day in Japan. They grew up on fish, all different kinds of fish and seafood. And they do eat pork and chicken and beef in Japan. And then in China, the average consumption is 2 teaspoons a day.
Of soy,
yeah. It is used as a flavoring and a condiment. It is not used as a meat substitute in these countries. And in China, the main source of calories is pork. It's the main meat that they eat. So this is a huge myth that Asians eat a lot of soy. Soy is a typical component of that diet and gives a typical flavoring that we see in the soy in the foods there. But it is not a staple, it's a flavoring.
Because they ferment it. They ferment the soybean, you see. And this is all borne out in the book that Sally's publishing company, New Trends Publishing, and the book is called The Whole Soy Story. Whole Soy Story. And that gives you the answer to all those sort of things.
Okay? Hmm. Hmm.
Yeah, that we're very proud of the fact of our soy-free mix. And we also worked very hard to get our costs down. We were buying an organic soy-free mix that cost us 48 cents a pound. And we decided, and it was a long ways away to get it, wasn't local. We really want to support local farms, so we sourced out local grains, and we bought a grinder, and we grind the grains fresh and add the minerals fresh, and we've cut our feed costs in half, and it's worked out really well, for us. Do you want to go out and see the pigs?
Sure enough.
Okay.
So these are your pigs.
This is some of the pigs. So,
and what breed are they?
Oh, well, they're Berkshire
pigs.
Yes, it'd be a Berkshire cross, really. Yeah.
And you see, they're in the woods here. If you look over there, you'll see that the woods are all clear. Mm-hmm. Completely denuded the forest floor. And that's a good thing. That's what nature likes. It likes disturbance and then rest so it can recuperate. And you'll have a much healthier forest that way. And so what we do is every 2 weeks we move them to new pasture and allow the old place that they were to recover. Yeah. And so here they are starting to clear all this.
And you can see by the stumps, we've just had the place filled. Logs are filled from here, and there'll be regeneration after this. I'm a real believer in having our forests regenerate. Because the trees get too old, and sometimes they fall over and you're losing the value of the timber.
So you sell your timber?
Yeah. Yes.
We have a lumber yard right down the road. That is a tremendous asset for a farm. But here
those
you can.
Are oaks?
They were mostly tulip poplars.
Tulip poplars.
That's what
which is a native species to
the.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can see how happy the pigs are. There's little, if any, smell.
Just and they root, which is what they're supposed
they
to do.
They do. They root right. and
that's
they
right.
eat roots.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, pigs at home, if I had them outside, I'd actually put a ring in their nose to stop them from rooting.
Really?
You see? Oh, yeah, but this is free range for them, and they just think this is marvellous. Hey? And the consequence, they'll also have a pretty good sort of bacon out of them.
Few, if any, flies. Yeah. And the chickens out here pecking away as well. So everybody's happy.
They look very happy.
Now, when they're through in here, we'll throw down some seed, and we'll eventually get pasture for the cows in the summer.
This will become pasture beyond the fence.
Yes. So the goal is a kind of savanna.
That was Sally Fallon Morell, PA Bowen Farmstead in Brandywine, Maryland. I'm Mark Steiner, host of Soundbites on Delmarva. We have to take a very short break. Don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear more from the Morells about their biodynamic style of farming and their visions of sustainable agriculture. Also, we'll hear from Yates Claggett, who raises cattle in Prince George's County. And we'll be right back, so don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, host of Soundbites on Delmarva. Today, we're visiting farms in Prince George's County, Maryland. Let's jump right back into our conversation with Sally Fallon Morell and Jeffrey Morell of P.A. Bowen Farmstead in Brandywine. I asked them about the distribution system and how lack of access to slaughterhouses and other distribution infrastructure affects small farmers.
So when you said a moment ago, you said that the distribution system is a problem. Almost every, that seems to be an issue when we talk about how small farmers can either access slaughterhouses or access distribution points, that's a huge issue in terms of how people get their produce and product out to market.
Yeah. It really comes down to the consumer. If the consumer wants to support this type of farm, they need to be willing to do the farmers markets, do the CSA, or in our case, come to the store. And it depends on what kind of food and what kind of agricultural system you want in the future. Do you want hundreds and thousands and millions of beautiful small farms adding fertility to the soil and producing really nutritious food? Or do you want an industrial food system that destroys the soil and gives you empty food that eventually causes lots of health problems? So it's really up to the consumer to support this or not to support this.
And also you have that freedom in fact, to have that choice. That's the important thing, the freedom to have that choice. Mm.
The butcher is a problem. We can butcher chickens on the farm. We're set up here to do, I think it's 20,000 birds a year we can do. So we butcher all our chickens here. They're every week. They're totally fresh. But for we have to take our food, our pork and our cows to a our beef cows to a USDA inspected butcher.
Fair enough.
Which is fair enough, but the problem is they're none close, and they're always being shut down. The small ones are constantly being shut down. So we do take our meat goes into Virginia, a butcher in Virginia, and he does things the old-fashioned way. For example, our bacon is truly smoked, old-fashioned way.
Now, in New Zealand, we wouldn't have had to take the animals so far because there are so many that are home kill. So the butcher comes along to the farm, and you knock off the animal and string it up and so on. Everything is dealt there, and the meat is then taken away and hung for a couple of weeks. But all the slaughtering is done on the farm. So this is what we talk about, a portable sawmill, slaughterhouse, just like a portable sawmill.
Well, that's, and I know that in some farms, and a friend of mine who farm in Oregon, he's a cattle rancher, on land we used to have. There is a portable slaughterhouse that somebody goes from farm to farm, and but there's only one or two of them, so they're always backed up because they don't have enough.
We're getting one here. The guys down in St. Mary's County, it'll be a truck that comes and kills your animals on the farm, and then he takes them back and hangs them and everything. But there have been a lot of hoops to jump through. But I think in a year or so, we will actually have local slaughtering. That is the biggest problem for this food system right now is the lack of small abattoirs.
And, abattoir being?
Slaughterhouse. And USDA is really proud of the fact that they've made their system efficient by getting everything into great big slaughterhouses. But what it means is the farmer often has to drive all day long to get to this slaughterhouse.
Husband has the hose on.
Yeah, you're right. Just showing you how easy it is to wash this down.
That was Sally Fallon Morell of P.A. Bowen Farmstead. The Morells took us on a tour of their pasture, where their animals work together to keep their land fertile.
Nothing is wasted on this farm.
Everything
is recycled in some way. So the whey from making the cheese is used to feed the pigs. The chickens have a very important role on the farm. You notice there's no flies in here. And last year we had cows and no chickens, and we had a terrible problem with flies. What the chickens do is go through the cow patties and eat the fly larvae, and then they spread the cow manure, and it just completely takes care of the flies. Those are the laying hens that do that. The meat birds, we have them in these what we call chicken tractors, and they're moved every day, and they put a layer of chicken manure on the pasture. So every animal has a role and fits in with some other animal on the farm. I'm going to show you a cow patty here. That's a cow patty that hasn't been worked on by the chickens. And here's one that the chickens have gone through and gotten all the fly larvae, and then they scratch it and spread it.
The argument's back and forth about this, about the chicken manure. You know how it's spread across farms, yeah. And the nitrogen and phosphorus run off into the bay and to our watersheds. So, and that's always been part of the arguments about farming, and obviously. But so tell me how this is any different.
I think it's not so concentrated, you know. This is kind of spread out and it's over time, and because it's worked on by the chickens, it very quickly works in. As soon as we get some rain, there'll be grass growing out of this.
Now this is a perfectly natural way of doing this.
Okay, we're going to go down to the chickens down
here.
Okay. They're laying eggs in here.
They're sitting on eggs and laying them. See the eggs?
These are eggs you're selling to eat, or these
yes.
are eggs?
These are... Yes, we don't hatch our chickens here. We get we buy chickens in, and the reason we don't is because you need a very skilled person called a chicken sexer to know the...
Turn the chicken inside out to tell whether it's a male or female.
You don't want to be wasting your feed raising a lot of male chickens.
That's right. And you'll notice the water is always ever-present. You've got to have water for the chickens. You've got to have them for bees. You've got anything that needs water.
Oh, yeah, wow. She's been busy. And see, that's what's natural about the different colors.
Yeah,
the variation
yes,
colors
yes,
that come.
Blue and pale and brown, yeah. So I just wanted to say our poultry house here is an old-fashioned poultry house. It's on stilts, which are pillars, which it keeps the snakes out. And the goal is to keep our chickens, our ducks, and our geese in there. And they will have access to the pond every day. And I would like to do some natural foie gras, where it's very humane. You don't stuff them or anything. But in the fall, you let them run in the orchards, and they get all the fruit on the ground, and they naturally get the fatty liver that way. So we're going to try that.
That was Sally Fallon-Morell of P.A. Bowen Farmstead in Brandywine, Maryland. We also heard from Jeffrey Morell. Now we continue our journey in Prince George's County with Yates Claggett, a small-scale cattle farmer who's been selling his grass-fed meat locally in the D.C. metro area. He's also the PG County Farm Bureau president and has spearheaded the purchase of freezers for local meat sales. He talked to us about what sustainability means to him in terms of the environmental and economic viability, and he documented the challenges the current distribution infrastructure in Southern Maryland, changing regulations, and market forces play in his quest to raise quality beef.
My full-time job is with the Soil Conservation District, and I run the land preservation programs in the county. And I'm also the Farm Bureau president here in the county. So I am involved in every facet of agriculture here in specifically Prince George's and Southern Maryland as a whole. And one of my goals is to see sustainable agriculture stick here in Southern Prince George's. Well, in all of Prince George's, actually. But
the Southern's
where the breadbasket is,
right.
You know. And the western side, where you guys were earlier at the Potomac, there's some agriculture over there, but not as much as you're in the heart of it right here. And we are in such an amazing area of Baltimore, Annapolis, Washington, you know, Northern Virginia. I mean, our markets are so close. We have such a great advantage compared to, you know, a lot of people where they may be trucking food and commodities for, you know, 100 miles or more, you know, where my customers can come right to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're coming right out of Washington, D.C., a half an hour, come experience the farm, buy some meat. You know, we are in a prime location here. Well, this is not my home farm. This is my cousin's farm. My home farm is right down the road there. We have 250 acres right on the Patuxent River, most gorgeous place in the world. Wow. I consider myself one of the luckiest fellas in, you know, around because, I grew up in it. So, and I was raising tobacco at the time. Just to give you a quick history. So I was raising tobacco right up till 2004, and then the buyout truly started in 2000. That's when everybody started receiving the checks. But I was young. I figured, you know what? I'm not going to take that money. I can raise enough tobacco that I'll make more money instead of taking the buyout. Well, what I didn't know, because I was young and dumb, is that when everybody else took the buyout, the market was going to crash. So the buyers stopped coming. So I learned a valuable lesson there. And there was one horse over here for all this pasture, and I was bush hogging it. You know, because it was my wife's horse, my cousin's farm. He wasn't doing anything. So that's just ridiculous. I'm going to buy some cows. Well, I had never owned a four-legged animal except a dog in my entire life. So go and buy six commercial cows. Next thing I know, I got 12 and then 20. And then I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do with these cows? You know, they were pets. So, and that's how we got into the meat market stuff. And I started really getting into the genetics and the, you know, grass-based system of feeding. And, you know, that's how I got to where I am today. This is the seventh year I've had cows, and the first year I finally broke even.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So I sold enough this year to pay back all my bills. Well, over the past, you know, I've been selling, but still was in the underneath. And finally this year, after 7 years of having a herd, finally broke even. Farming's not a profitable situation. As much as people would love to say that it is, it's not easy.
We visited with Fred and Suzanne Mason, who are over in Queen Anne's.
Okay.
They have an organic grain operation. They made this huge business switch and said, we're dropping all the commodity farming, and we're just going to be strictly raised organic grain, which is a very different business.
It sure is.
But they're saying it's a business that they think is going to grow, and it's a business that has probably more longevity, and they can actually at this point name their price.
Yes.
As opposed to the others who are kind of tied to large agribusiness have to take the price they're given.
And that's a very good point, because I name my price. I grow strictly beef, grass-fed, all natural. Like you said, I sell a quarter of a beef for $6.50 a pound, and that's about 100 pounds of finished meat. I'm grossing about $2,400 a cow. I can't take that cow to the market you know, at Westminster or Fredericksburg or wherever it is, and get that kind of money. Hence, I'm naming my own price. Now, I have to do some marketing, which, you know, let's be honest, farmers aren't good. Some farmers aren't good people. So that's been an adaptation that a lot of these farmers have had to do. I've had to do it, and I'm fine with that. I love having people come out to the farm. I invite all my customers to come out here, and because I want them to see it. And I think they get a more of appreciation of where their food's coming from. But the commodity guy, you're right, he's at the mercy of Purdue. You know, Purdue's going to say, this is what we're paying based on the Chicago Board of Trade, and we may pay a 50 cents over the basis, which is great. But at other times, right now, they're probably 50, 60 cents under the basis on wheat.
How do you see all this happening? When you said that you want to see this area become a center for sustainable farming, southern part of Prince George's County, how do you envision that? What is that? How does that look?
Very diverse types of small farms with, obviously, grain, you know, commodity crops mixed in. We have roughly 60,000 acres of agriculturally assessed property in Prince George's County.
60,000 acres.
60,000 acres. That's more than Calvert County. That's more than Howard County. But the point is, people think of Prince George's. They think of National Harbor, the Beltway.
All development.
There is so much land out here that can be used.
I never even knew that this existed, that this country, that we had farmland this vast
in
Prince George's.
This close to Washington,
D.C.? I had no idea.
And I could blindfold you, and you wouldn't know. You'd think you were in West Virginia or something right now, wouldn't you? I mean, isn't that amazing? And that's what I want to preserve. You know, my job is to preserve land, and I go around and I buy easements, you know, through the state programs and our own county program. But if, like I said, if we don't do something with it, you know, what's it all for? My goal before I retire from my job is to hopefully preserve about 20,000 acres here in Prince George's County. And if we can keep a critical mass of farmland, we keep our Southern States dealers, we keep our tractor implement deals, we keep those services here, and we keep a valuable, valuable food source right here in our county that our citizens here in the county deserve. Much of the area inside the Beltway, they don't have the opportunity to go and buy these fruits and vegetables. We got to be here to provide that, you know, and we got to be here so that those inner city kids can come out and experience a farm and appreciate a farm and know where that egg came from and know where that milk came from. And if those kids don't have that opportunity, if they don't have an opportunity to eat a fresh cantaloupe or a fresh watermelon or a piece of sugar corn that's grown 15, 20 minutes from their house, we've lost something.
Can and or should farmers be able to grow food, whether you call it organic or natural, but sustainable farming methods? Can that take over from the large commodity? Should it even? And can you transform agriculture to feed people in a different way? Is that possible?
No.
Or is this, you don't think it's possible?
No, you can't feed the world I can't feed the world. I had 20 customers this year that are going to be in beef, hopefully, for next year because they bought, you know, 100 pounds of beef. That's 20 people. That grain farmer that's raising the 50 acres of corn on my farm down there is feeding hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. We got to keep those big farmers. You know, whether they're in the Midwest or whether they're here or on the Eastern Shore, they're the ones that are going to feed the world. I'm not going to feed the world. I'm going to feed a select few here in the county, hopefully, you know, and do the best I can. But let's face it, not everybody can afford to buy my beef. You know, I mean, that's just the way life is. There's got to be affordable beef out there. You know, not everybody can afford to buy organic, homegrown, local, whatever, you name it. We've got to feed the masses, and farmers are doing that right now. And that, I tell you, that includes Purdue, ADM, Tyson's. I mean, you need those. And I know there's a stigma about big ag, but who else is going to feed the world? We can't do that at this small scale. And you know, while we're on that, Purdue and the chicken industry on the shore, which gets slammed time and time and time again. But I can tell you one thing, you mark my words, you lose the chicken industry on the shore, and you're going to lose agriculture in Maryland completely, because those chickens are what keeps the big guys buying the services that I use also. They're keeping the fertilizer dealers here. They're keeping the feed and seed, the equipment dealers here. I'm not. If we lose the chicken industry, agriculture in Maryland is going to be either very, very different, or it's going to be non-existent, in my opinion.
So how do you define sustainable farming? How do you see that working in this area? Can Prince George's County feed Washington, D.C.?
Probably not, but Southern Maryland possibly could. Or, I mean, the all of Maryland probably could. You know, I don't think there's enough farmland here in Prince George's to feed the masses, you know. But we can feed a lot, you know. And we've got a long way to go. There's going to be changes here in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Just like we've seen changes. You don't see any tobacco anymore.
Right, it's gone.
And now you're seeing increased beef herds. Retail marketing, local marketing, more vegetables. I'm seeing vegetable guys pop up all over the place. The winery and the vineyards and even Sally's Dairy. And I know a couple other guys that would like to try what she's doing. I think we're this part of Prince George's is going to be a very sustainable and diverse food system right here. We need some things. We need an aggregator of sorts to put all our vegetables together. To be able to distribute. We need a distribution system here. It doesn't exist right now. You know, if I want to get my vegetables into Washington, D.C., I've got to take them in myself in the back of my truck and set up at the Union Market Station or you know, there's a couple of the farmers' markets down there and do it myself. A lot of farmers don't want to do that, you know, so we need a place that Joe Farmer can bring all his produce, aggregate it, and then get it out. If we can get him a little bit more money, you know, because it's local, because it's a premium, he's going to stay in business. You know, if he's selling wholesale all the time, you know, it's a year-to-year thing. Because I can't produce enough to supply Giant. But if me and my neighbor and a couple of other guys down the street, if we get a large enough, then they'll deal with us. You know, and that's what we're missing. We're missing in some type of aggregation.
So people have argued that one of the problems with small farms and sustainable farming is there's no infrastructure, whether it's infrastructure for people who are raising hogs and cattle, or whether it's milk, or whether it's vegetables, slaughterhouses. There's no infrastructure here.
And that was my second thing that I was going to say is we need a slaughterhouse down here. We need a USDA slaughterhouse and butcher. Right now, my cows get on a trailer and travel 2 hours, whether it's to Mount Airy, whether it's down in Virginia, to Fauquier County. Wherever it is, those cows got to travel. And if I could move them 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, that's so much better for the cow. So much easier for me. It's cheaper for me. We're missing that. Southern Maryland needs that. And the problem is, right now, we don't have enough animals here in Southern Maryland to sustain a business like that. But it's like the chicken and the egg. Well, what do? If we had a slaughterhouse, more people would be raising animals for feed. But because we don't have it, people are tentative about increasing their herds because of the transportation issue. The quality of the meat, I believe, from the very birth to the time it goes to the butcher, the quality of meat depends on the attitude of the cow. And if that cow is kept calm its entire life and has a wonderful little environment, lovely, you know, grass to eat and this and that and everything's nice, the quality of meat's going to be great. But anytime you stress that cow out, you know, whether it's getting on that trailer and riding 2 hours, That affects the meat quality. And so one of my goals is to not stress these cows out. And if I had a butcher really close, that would help out. The other thing that, you know, besides Mother Nature that we have to deal with is a lot of new regulations. You know, and that's scary for the smaller guys. Those bigger guys, they can deal with it. Small guys like me, you take, for instance, the new nutrient management regulations that are coming down the pipe. These are state regulations put in place by MDA and the governor. And it... I'm not getting political, but the point is, the truth of the matter is, if I have to comply with those new regulations, which some of them are saying, I can't spread my manure during certain times of the year. Well, what am I going to do with it? Now I've got to build a structure to store that manure. Can I, as a small farmer, afford that? Probably not, you know? And so what happens to me? Well, if I can't comply with those regulations, guess what? I'm done. And a lot of small farmers right now are going to face that. I hope that doesn't happen, and I hope there's some flexibility in some of these new regulations. And, of course, with the TMDLs and the WIP 2s coming down, TMDLs are total daily maximum load.
Of nitrogen and phosphorus coming into the river.
Nitrogen and phosphorus going into the Chesapeake Bay. Right. And then the WIPs are the Watershed Habitat Improvement. Basically means that the state of Maryland and the counties have to come up with a plan to conserve a certain amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. And what's washing off the farms? What's washing off the urban environment? You know, who is responsible for what? And they're divvying that up. And so, you know, and it's a struggle. I mean, I feel sorry for these guys that are trying to make these decisions because their agriculture's taking a brunt of it, you know, and agriculture is easy to pick on because we're a very small voting bloc. But it seems that we always brunt the burden of the health of the Chesapeake Bay. And granted, we're the largest land use, But, you know, you see very little impervious surface here. You see very little sediment running off here. I'm not fertilizing my lawn, you know, in excess, which a lot of, I believe, you know, the urban folks are doing it. The golf courses are doing it.
Right.
Where I'm using as little of fertilizer as I can to make that grass grow because I can't afford it. So, and there's a whole lot more to that, and I don't know how we got on this subject, but...
I don't either, but we got this on.
But we got there, and, well, my concern is that can the small farmer continue to farm with all these new added regulations?
Is there a difference between how that affects, or these things affect a smaller operation like yours, or like Bowen's, or like some of the other small, quote-unquote, sustainable farms, as opposed to the...
It's a volume thing. You know, where the large, say I'm a large cattle farmer and I got 200 or 300 cows. Well, you know, I can spread that expense out over 200 or 300 cows. And of course, I've got a much larger income where, you know, my income is minor. But I have to build the same structure to store that manure as that big guy does. Because the way I understand it, between November and March, you're not going to be able to spread animal manure on the land. And one of the problems with that is I can't spread it anytime else because I graze my cows all the way up through December, and I certainly don't want them grazing on, you know, land that I've spread their manure on. And in March, you know, the grass is just starting to peak and grow, and I certainly don't want to put manure out there that a couple weeks later I'm going to put cows on. So you see the dilemma there. The big guy, you know, we've got to build you know, a manure storage structure, which, you know, in my situation would probably have to be sized big enough, maybe about $10,000 structure. Well, the same, that other guy, his structure may be $20,000, but either way, you know, that's $10,000 of money that I don't have.
So how would you design the system differently then?
Well, I wouldn't. I think we have mandatory nutrient management right now, and I believe 98%, you have to check that number, but almost every farmer in the state has a nutrient management plan, and pretty much for the most part are following it. Farmers are not putting any more nutrients on the ground than we have to because our margins are so small. I'm not going to spread another ounce of fertilizer out there if I don't have to do it. So if the nutrient management plan says spread 120 pounds of fertilizer, which is what my nutrient management plan says, I can spread 120 pounds of nitrogen on this hay and pasture land. Well, this year alone, I've just spread 80. And I'm not planning on spreading anymore because I can't afford it. So let's stick with the nutrient management plans. They work, you know. But these excess burdens that you're putting on us, like the manure stuff, you know, we're doing a fine job with what we're doing. Leave me alone. Leave me alone to my own toil. This land right here is better for the Chesapeake Bay, even with 20 cows on it, than 15 houses. You know, and if I can't afford to farm this, what's going to happen to it? We're going to build 15 houses here, you know. You know, hopefully one day, you know, we can get some people back to full-time farming, but I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
Not without the infrastructure, not without the distribution system.
Yeah, not without a lot of things changing, you know. It just becomes a thing of, it's a scale of volume and profitability. And, you know, I can grow and grow and grow, but I got to have a market for it, which I think we do, but we're still developing it. You know, we're still, these markets are young. This local food thing, you know, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. It's not a trend.
That was our conversation with Yates Clackett, who runs a small, grass-fed cattle operation in Prince George's County. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Dr. Lisa Hayes, Molly Meehan, Sky Harmon, and Polly Festa from the Akakeek Foundation, Sally Fallon Morell and Jeffrey Morell from the P.A. Bowen Farmstead, and Yates Clackett, cattle farmer, Prince George's County, and Farm Bureau President. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. And made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.